When Casey Nicole Swenson announced that her leukemia had returned, her friend Halcyon encouraged her to write about her experiences online.
I remember her calling me and her telling me that she had been diagnosed with leukemia. And this, like, just painful, hollow feeling. How do I talk to this young woman who is dealing with this incredibly powerful experience? And at the time, I had been having so much growth as I was chronicling my life online that I encouraged her to share her journey. She was such an optimistic person, and she had such a powerful effect on the people that she communicated with in our community that I thought it would be a healthy practice for her to share her journey.
I'm beginning a new, exciting journey. It's a journey into my survival. I want to win. I'll fight till the finish.
20 years ago, a series of events rocked the fledgling internet. I'm Alice Fiennes.
And I'm Poppy Damon. You're listening to Pseudocide, a Furrowed Brow production about death fraud through the ages. Pseudocide is the act of faking your own death. And this is episode 2, Living Colors, the surprising death of a teenage internet star.
This episode is about a young woman named Casey Nicole Swenson, what happened to her, and the lives she touched. It's also the story of an uncharted frontier at the dawn of a new millennium, of ordinary people getting online for the first time and discovering the internet. It's a tale of duplicity, but it's also about connection and affinity and human understanding.
My name is Halcyon. I have been exploring the digital frontier for many, many, many years. Started with documenting my life and living in a webcam house, and now continue to explore how we can connect and share love and goodness through this crazy digital world.
In 1999, Halcyon was working for a website called College Club. This was an early forerunner of Facebook, and it's where he met Casey Nicole. Halcyon has bright pink hair, and his energy is just as vibrant. He describes himself as an authenticity coach and lifestyle artist. He's also a regular at Burning Man, where he gifts ice cucumber water and vegan ice cream as a founder of Pink Heart Camp. And he has a YouTube channel called Hug Nation, where he leads a worldwide digital hug once a week. If you're wondering what a digital hug looks like...
So people get in front of their webcams all around the world, and we grab ourselves, hold ourselves, and imagine that we are hugging one another and hugging the people in our lives, and try to remind ourselves that it doesn't matter where your feet are at, it matters where your heart is at. And then we just share a moment, and it's kind of magical.
But in 1999, before YouTube existed, Halcyon was known for his online journal, cockybastard.com. And as we mentioned before, he was also working for College Club, which was one of the first college community sites.
It actually had a business plan that was very much like Facebook, kind of get all the college students connected online and then grow with them as they go into their lives, and then grab more and more of the world and into a single community. And so it had email, and we had phone voice to email, because there were so many people that still were not using computers. And it was really the first social network that I was aware of before that was a thing.
And when you're working at College Club, what do you do?
I was the community lead. If you join College Club, I would be your first friend. Basically just the kind of voice and face of the site. So the marketing materials and everything had my face on it. And I was kind of a mascot.
Casey Nicole was another friendly face on College Club. Halcyon was her supervisor, and he remembers that she was committed to her work.
She would check in with me and give me updates on what she was doing. She became kind of the leader of the chat hosts, and she would write a newsletter that she would send out to all of our chat hosts. And she would send me messages and phone messages and keep me updated in some things with her life and things with the community that were going on. Over the course of the year and a half that she worked for me, she gave me, I don't know, hundreds of hours of free labor as a volunteer, as a chat host.
I guess to change the course of history, we all have to start with ourselves. It seems some people just haven't got the big picture yet. I feel rather sorry for them.
Casey was actually a high school student when Halcyon first met her. College Club wasn't supposed to include high school students in its community, but it made an exception for Casey. She would be at college soon, and in any case, she was special.
We decided that because she was so dynamic and so popular, really, in the community, that it would make sense for her to be one of our chat hosts.
So when you say she's dynamic and popular in the community, she's got loads of connections, basically.
Many of the people who were enthusiastic internet users at the time did fall into the category of people who were socially awkward or misfits. And people who are spending their entire social lives in a digital space may have been overcoming other aspects of insecurity. And Casey physically looked like and acted like someone who was a popular kid. And therefore, people treated her with almost a reverence in the community that was unusual.
Everyone who encountered Casey agreed. There was a kind of magic to her. In August 2000, she even spoke by phone to a New York Times journalist about her vibrant online social life, where computers were the new college dorm room essential. She noted that this was a world away from her mother's college experience, when cassette players and calculators had been novelties.
Saundra Mitchell and Patrick Cleary weren't friends with Casey themselves, but by the time she had moved on from high school to college, they had heard of her. They had also come across her online journal, Living Colors, where she wrote poetry and related her struggles with cancer alongside the ordinary, everyday happenings of her life at home in Kansas. Here's Saundra and Patrick.
Casey Nicole is a beautiful 19-year-old basketball star who has just started college, but she's been suffering from cancer throughout her entire teen years, and she is this huge inspiration to all sorts of people online because she has a perpetually positive attitude no matter what she's going through.
She is an athlete. She is a student. She plays basketball and is young and blonde and pretty. Like most journalists, she doesn't have very many pictures online, but the ones that she does have are of her with her basketball team, of her being an athlete.
I'm a new star shining bright above the still and silent night. And as you gaze within, you see my sparkle and vitality. A million smiles for you I hold, sometimes shy but often bold. I wink with a mischievous eye and ponder all the reasons why. Life is wonderful from my view.
When she goes to the hospital, she tells us what it's like to be in the hospital. When she's at home in college, she tells us what it's like to be a freshman for the first time. She talks a lot about her mom, Debbie, and how great she is and what a support she is.
Tell me no, I'll show you yes. Guess what I did? Come on, guess. I walked. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, I didn't go far, but I did it, and I did it all by myself. Yeehaw. I told the nurses, please let me get up. I even begged, and they said no. So when the doctor came in, I asked, please let me get up and walk around. They said, Casey, you can't. You're still very weak. Give it some time. I said, watch me. I can do it. Well, I was slow, and I only walked from one side of my bed to the other. It took a lot of concentration, biting my lip and pauses along the way. And man, did it zap my energy, but I did it. Tell me no, I'll show you yes. You can do it. It's done. Now you can smile.
She writes in a way that is wise beyond her years. She is incredibly mature in dealing with her emotions, in dealing with the struggles that come with being hospitalized. She thinks about other people. She tries to make sure that her mother is being taken care of emotionally.
The sun shines today. Woohoo! Thanks to some better medicine, I actually feel like a human being for a change. I slept well and I woke up smiling. There are a few reasons why I was smiling. Mom was curled up in a chair next to my bed, sleeping with a cover pulled up to her chin. She didn't look comfortable at all, but she had the cutest expression on her face. Her head was tilted in this awkward position, and a few strands of her hair were touching her cheek. A ray of sunshine seemed to spotlight her, and I felt the peacefulness wrap me in its warmth. I realized she always makes me feel wrapped in sunshine.
Sometimes, Casey's mother, Debbie, would also post on her own blog about her daughter's treatment in hospital.
I told her I loved her and everything was going to be all right. She was told not to walk or move around. Green, glassy eyes looked at me as blood trickled out of her mouth. The urge to hold her as I had when she was a child was fierce.
So Casey enchanted her followers. To understand her particular charisma, you really need to understand an online scene that took off in the 1990s. As ordinary people started using the internet for the first time, journals appeared and multiplied online. The diarists, also known as excribitionists, had followers. They formed communities and they even held conferences. Keep in mind, computers looked completely different. The internet looked completely different. And for people getting online for the very first time, it was a brave new world. Here's Patrick again.
My name is Patrick Cleary. I was an online journaler from 1997 until about 2005. Online journalers were people who wrote their diaries online and allowed other people to read them.
Today, Patrick no longer journals online. He describes himself as a playwright and cat owner, but he remembers his journaling days vividly.
Do you know how many readers you had?
I know that I was very excited when I broke 100 readers a day. That was several years into it. I did have a very dedicated audience of probably about 100, 150 people who would read, most of whom would read at least a couple times a week.
Eventually, the internet moved on.
The online journaling space turned more into blogging, and the folks who weren't able to make money blogging found themselves really sort of pushed out of the space.
As social media grew more popular, Patrick says people started to share their lives in much more digestible chunks on Facebook and on Twitter. Still, a number of the popular journalers went on to become successful writers for film and television, including Stephen Falk, who wrote for Weeds and Orange is the New Black, and Pamela Ryben, who co-wrote Moana.
People who are truly talented writers started out in that medium. I don't think they got discovered because of it, but I know that they were young and they were honing their skills, and it was very obvious that that talent was there.
Saundra Mitchell is one of those talented writers who began flexing her creative muscles in the journaling space. Today, she's a novelist. She's sharp and forthright and cheerful.
My name is Saundra Mitchell. I'm an author of books for tweens. I am also an editor of books for tweens. And I write primarily realistic fantasy and contemporary fiction for teens. I'm very proud of my anthologies where I bring in other young adult authors and I set them free with a very simple, what do you wish that you had to read when you were 16? And All Out and Out Now follow that particular idea explicitly for queer YA authors writing for queer teens. It's stories where we finally get to be centered as heroes or monsters or adventurers instead of talking about all of the terrible things that can sometimes come with being queer in the modern world.
Who are you in 2000?
In 2000, I am a young mother who's working on being a screenwriter. The amazing thing about the internet is that suddenly I'm in the middle of America where nothing happens and nobody goes on to have those careers where you have big dreams unless you leave. And so for me, it's this big wide opening. It's this suddenly I can reach out and talk to people in LA and they talk back to me. It's this amazing wide open world, but I have to say that it's also, according to everybody I know, full of axe murderers.
Saundra ended up meeting her wife online.
And everybody was like, but you can't meet the people on the internet. They're all dangerous. Everybody was dangerous. It was fine if you are talking to people online, but when you're talking about actually meeting them in person, it's all axe murderers.
everybody thought that it was going to be some sort of an axe murderer. It was like, how could you meet somebody that you've never met before? You don't know this person. Call me when it's over, that sort of thing.
It's axe murderers all the way down.
That whole axe murderer thing is really about how much the internet represented the unknown. But with that unknown came infinite potential.
Everybody thinks the internet is the Wild West because you simply don't know what's going to happen when you go on the internet. At the same time, it was this amazing free place where you could be anything you wanted. Like, I meet my wife in Alt Vampires, and in Alt Vampires, there are people who are pretending to be vampires. There are people who are writing about vampires. There are people who are just there because they like horror fiction. All of us are there all mingling together for our own weird random reasons. So the internet is, to anybody who's not on it, automatically somewhat suspect because it's like this club and it definitely has a cover. And part of that cover is simply having the technical know-how to get there. And that cuts off vast swaths of people who are just like, I don't get what the internet is. I cannot emphasize enough how much people did not get what the internet is in 2000.
So from the outside, the web was shadowy and mystifying. But on the inside, the journaling community was all about finding kindred spirits and connecting with them. What's more, the internet wasn't monetized in quite the same way as it is today.
It was considered gauche, at least in the diary circles, to write for money. The internet was very much for connecting with other people. In my experience, when the internet first appeared, it seemed like it was going to be this amazing way to communicate directly with other people without the interference of commercials like you would see on TV or your company interfering or anything, because it just felt so direct.
Sometimes those direct connections were a lifeline.
I had a young child. I had not a great marriage. I didn't have a car. So that was my way to go places.
Sandra and I connected because we were both writers. We found each other's journals and then went on AOL Instant Messenger late at night because she was up with a baby and I worked night shifts. So being able to talk to somebody that I had never met at that time, who we were about the same age, we had the same interests, we had the same sense of humor, and nobody understood that you could feel so connected to somebody that you hadn't met before, whereas it's very commonplace nowadays.
For the first time, it was possible to reach out to strangers with a few taps of a keyboard, and those strangers could bare their souls to you directly. This was the internet's novelty and its magic.
Hold on to your seats. You're now entering, and smiles are mandatory. Laughter is necessary. This is my world, after all. Dare to dream.
Strangers could share their hopes, their fears, and their deepest, darkest secrets. But they'd also share the most casual and ordinary of moments. What they ate for breakfast, the colors of the autumn leaves as they drove to work that morning. You might be thousands of miles away, and you might only have one low-grade digital photo of them, but you knew them. To many, journals like Casey Nicole's were a kind of gift. Her entries about her illness, the treatment she was receiving, and her gratitude for her life were a mainstay of the journaling community.
It's been a hard road for me. You helped me reach within myself and let my inner strength shine. That was an invaluable gift to give, and thank you isn't near enough. All I can continue to give you is my love. I'll be watching over you, no worries. Sending you masses of sunshine and love, Casey.
And what is it about her that you think does appeal to people that follow her?
She's this wonderful angel who is making the very best of a terrible situation. You can talk to her directly on College Club, which had a forum and an early version of online chat called IRC, which is like super brand new. Like being able to talk to somebody real time is amazing. And so Casey is like super available and you just want to be like Casey.
Anybody who's facing adversity, especially somebody who's being very raw and emotional about it, is someone that you're going to find appealing. That's really something special to come across.
you want to look at your life and say, oh, wow, my problems are nothing, you know, compared to Casey's, and I can get through this. If Casey can get through her bad day, then I can get through mine.
Halcyon agreed, and he did what he could to boost Casey's readership.
It was a really compelling, heart-wrenching narrative that she was weaving. I remember at the time I had a little segment on a local radio show. It was called The Other Surf Report, where I would share a website each week. And I did a whole presentation about Casey.
Can you remember if it gave you a specific feeling reading her words?
I remember being able to feel a bit of, there seemed to be a sense of meaning when I read her words that made sense out of the meaninglessness of a young girl in such a terrible situation.
My life's been really good. I'm pretty happy with how it turned out. I wish there was more of it, but we don't get to direct that part of it. I just wanted you to know that I love you, and I hope that life gives you everything you're hoping for. You've got a great start. I know you've walked with happiness, but if you need a nudge, just check the stars. I'll be winking at you. Sending you love and sunshine. Casey.
It didn't last. Casey's life was cut tragically short when she passed away from her cancer, age 19.
Her mom posted something like a final statement on her blog that she had passed.
Thank you for the love, the joy, the laughter, and the tears. We shall love you always and forever. Casey Nicole passed away May 14, 2001, at the age of 19.
Saundra, again.
Everybody is devastated. Everybody knew that she was still being treated for cancer, but she had talked about how her last round of chemo was so successful, and then she suddenly dies.
She was such a symbolic expression of youth and energy and all that. And so it was pretty devastating. But at the same time, it was hard to separate my relationship with Casey from the kind of communal and community experience that we had of her. So even as I was grieving, I also felt this kind of almost like a pastor-like responsibility to be there for people.
Casey's death inspired communal mourning, which played out in chat rooms and online fora. As in life, she commanded attention. But while fans and followers eulogized, the hawk-eyed began to rake over the details of her tragic death. Saundra was asking questions.
It was just kind of like on the edge of my atmosphere. I knew that something was happening with Casey Nicole, that probably she had died, but that's all I had heard until my friend Becky Carpenter sent me an email and said, I don't want to say this out loud, and I know that you investigate things, so I just wanted to run this past you. I don't think Casey actually died.
More after this.
So, at some point, people start to realize that all may not be as it seems with Casey. Can you tell me about that?
She is in the hospital, and people have decided that they've known her long enough. They've talked to her on the phone. They've, you know, sent mail. They've sent gifts, things like that, that they decide that they're going to come and visit her. And her mother, Debbie, steps in and says, she's way too sick for visitors right now. If we could just hold off on that. And so most of the people who were going to go, they literally cancel, like, airfare and everything else that they've already arranged. But their benefactor, Randall, who lived in Hong Kong, who actually did all the technical stuff on the website for Casey, says, well, I'm going to come anyway, because he feels like he's particularly close to everybody. And so when he lets them know that he's going to arrive on this and this date, all of a sudden, Casey dies. It's like this huge ripple. And people who aren't following her hear about it because there are so many people who have been following her who are affected by it. I mean, they're heartbroken because nobody saw this coming. She was supposed to be the big success story. She just up and dies. And the weird thing is that they asked for no gifts, no flowers. And then 24 hours later, they say that she's already been buried.
Saundra's friend Becky, who had tracked this strange sequence of events, told Saundra that she thought this was odd, but she didn't know what to do about it.
And I'm like, well, I read a lot of true crime, so definitely I know what to do, which was ridiculous. I mean, you know, I didn't know what to do, but I had just enough technical knowledge that I could kind of poke around in places that maybe other people wouldn't think to poke around.
Saundra started looking at the code on Casey's website, and she noticed that the teenager would post at odd times. She would claim to be eating lunch in her Kansas hospital room, but the post would have been published at 2 o'clock in the morning in Kansas. Later, Saundra would find out that Randall, Casey's Hong Kong-based friend, published all her posts for her. Hong Kong is 13 hours ahead of Kansas, but at that point, the time lag seemed bizarre, and it was enough to keep Saundra hooked.
Next, she examined the photographs Casey had posted on her journal, Living Colors. Back in 2001, digital cameras and webcams had just become a thing.
If somebody posted something from a digital camera, you can look at the EXIF data that is coded into a picture, and it will tell you where the picture was taken, what time it was taken. At the time, a lot of them would actually give latitude and longitude, like exactly where it was taken. And there were a lot of pictures on Casey's online journal that just, they were from Texas when she is supposed to be in Kansas, or, you know, they're from Indiana when she's supposed to be in Kansas. Her pictures did not match up with where she was supposed to be when she allegedly took them. And so then I called all the major newspapers near the city that they were in to ask for an obituary. And there was no obituary. There was no death notice anywhere. And so I actually talked to a couple of journalists at a Lawrence, Kansas newspaper. And I basically explained the Casey Nicole story. And the journalists are like, if we had had, you know, that kind of feel-good story in Lawrence, Kansas, it would have been in the news. It's not a big town. So the journalists didn't know about that. There was no death notice. There was no obituary. The EXIF data on the pictures didn't make sense. So I called funeral homes looking for a service for Casey Nicole.
But no funeral home within 100 miles of Casey Nicole's town had provided services for a Swenson family.
So at that point, I feel confident that something is going on and it's not what they've actually told us. And that's when I turn to other people and I ask for their expertise.
Saundra is someone who loves to read detective novels. She loves crime TV shows. She loves that sort of procedural, and she has a very sharp mind for detail. And while we're talking, she says, can you take a look at a few of these entries that Casey wrote before she died? Does this sound like something that makes sense to you?
Saundra consulted her friend Patrick and another diarist called Rob Rummel Hudson. Rob pointed out that Casey didn't seem to listen to any contemporary music. What 19-year-old likes the Carpenters? Patrick studied the narrative arc of the whole journal.
I wanted him to look at the shape of the story when you read it all at once, just to verify that it's a weird balance of really, really high points all of the time and very little mundane stuff. Like, it would be like reading a book about George Washington, and the only thing it talks about is the cherry tree and the battle where he slaughtered all of his men out in the Midwest, and then the Revolutionary War, and then a president. It would be like saying that's his whole life. Martha's not in there. You know, the vineyard's not in there. His relationship with Jefferson and Hamilton is not in there. Those four things, that's all Washington did. And that's how Casey Nicole's journal read if you read it all at one time. Once everybody else looked at stuff and said, yeah, this is hinky, I sat down and I wrote a post for my online journal Headspace, and I basically break down the things that I looked at and the things that other people looked at. And I said, you know, I could be wrong, but I don't think Casey Nicole ever existed.
The journaling community was suddenly ablaze. Saundra had broken one of its tacit social codes. She'd questioned the authenticity of a member.
I set off a bomb because one of those unspoken rules is that you believe what people tell you on good faith. And here I am making this huge blog post, basically tearing apart this wonderful saint's life and explaining every single step of the way how I don't think she's real. I had a friend named Acrid Rabbit, and she said, hey, there's this website called Metafilter. All they do is people post interesting links to blog posts that they found in there, and then they talk about them there. And so Acrid Rabbit posts it to Metafilter, and that was the second bomb.
May 18th, 2001, 10 p.m. Is it possible that Casey did not exist? This is a really delicate thing here. Please be really thoughtful about this. I promise I am not trying to stir the shit without cause. There are some people who are wondering whether Casey was a real 19-year-old leukemia patient and whether things actually occurred the way they've been reported online. More inside, friends.
That was Acrid Rabbit reading her own post. Acrid Rabbit sees her on and offline lives as separate, which is why we'll refer to her by her Metafilter name only.
I went to an online name generator website, and it was one of the ones that came up. I liked how it sounded. It was alliterative and vaguely punk rock. I am a researcher in public health. I live in Los Angeles, and I'm a blogger and have been for a very long time.
And then it generates some responses, that post, right? People reply and people chime in with their own thoughts.
Yeah, it was epic, actually. It was really kind of epic. In that time, bandwidth was actually kind of limited. And so people were very concerned about the servers, that they weren't going to be able to keep up with the traffic because it lit up. People are starting to realize, you know, there may be something really here.
My page actually went down briefly because they did. I mean, so many people came to it, it got hammered. And I had to talk to my web space provider and pay for extra bandwidth because there were so many people hitting the site. And so I would say in the first 3 days, I went from having like a regular readership of about 120 people to 5,000-6,000 people hitting that page all at the same time. I mean, it was massive. It was absolutely stunning.
The reaction was vitriolic and angry. And how dare you? How dare you slander this poor young woman who's just died? How dare you say that this grieving mother isn't grieving? How dare you tell us that we're not grieving over this young woman who was absolutely real to us?
First, I had people who were furious that I would besmirch Casey Nicole's good name. And then on the other hand, you have these really analytical people who are like going through the points that I put in my blog, and they're like, huh, that does seem kind of hinky.
Casey's colleague, Halcyon, was outraged by the suggestion that she had never existed. Then suspicion started to turn on him.
Just as the conversation started to go into the realm of questioning, I could not face it. My brain just could not make possibility for that. And I got really angry. I could not comprehend the idea of us questioning this death at the time. And so as the conversation online continued and then people started to suggest that I had created her, at least I saw that in some thread, that she was a creation of mine, I struggled to not get angry. It took me a long time before I was ready to even make possibility in my mind. It just seemed like if I doubted her existence until it was absolutely certain, it just seemed like such a disrespect to this woman that I had shared experiences with, that she'd been a part of my life up until then.
But over time, Halcyon's unease grew.
As the Metafilter sleuths started adding more and more evidence and more questions that couldn't be answered, the dread kind of started to grow inside me of like, I can't answer these questions either. This really doesn't make sense. The conversation where we talked about her being sick and her crying on the phone is the one that kind of echoes in my brain, because I kept going back to that and saying, who was I talking to? I had physical vertigo because I had all these memories of talking to her and interacting with her that no longer were anchored in a reality that existed.
Once the Metafilter people got it, really all I was doing was sitting at home, being really afraid that I was wrong. Because there was the possibility that I was totally wrong, that, you know, I had decided to be an amateur sleuth, and now I have hurt this family beyond all reason. And so I sat there, and it was over a weekend that I didn't touch the journal. I commented a couple of times on Metafilter, but otherwise I disengaged. So the Metafilter people, they go to town. And the first spark that I was right is somebody on Metafilter took one of the pictures of Casey Nicole playing basketball and zeroed in on the logo, the mascot logo, on the floor of the basketball court. And they figured out which school it belonged to. Once they figured out which school it belonged to, they contacted the school in some way and found out that the girl in the picture was another girl entirely.
This woman, who was at college in Oklahoma, had no idea that her photos had appeared in Casey Nicole's journal. Though, strangely, according to the New York Times, she had once been acquainted with the Swensons.
That's when everybody was like, oh, wait. And then they found out that somebody had been active on her college club account after she had allegedly died. And from there, we ended up talking to the guy in Hong Kong. And for a while, we thought the guy in Hong Kong was like in on the whole thing.
But the guy in Hong Kong, Casey's tech support, Randall, wasn't in on the whole thing. Only one person was. Eventually, Casey Nicole's real identity was revealed.
A million smiles for you I hold, sometimes shy but often bold. I wink with a mischievous eye and ponder all the reasons why
life is wonderful from my view. I guess to change the course of history, we all have to start with ourselves. Hold on to your seats.
You're now entering and smiles are mandatory. Laughter is necessary.
This is my world, after all. Dare to dream.
Finally, Casey Nicole's mother, Debbie Swenson, admitted that she had made up Casey Nicole.
Her name was not Casey, and she was not my daughter, but I loved her as if she had been, and I grieve her loss. The blog was about the lives of three people who suffered, one with breast cancer, one with leukemia, and one with liver cancer. Each were strong, vibrant, and loving individuals. Each were real. Each died much too soon. I alone bear the shame for what I've done, but it was not done for any reason other than sharing the love for life they gave to those they loved. I would like to clear up some falsehoods that have been spread around. There was never a PayPal account. There was never an Amazon wish list. If donations were made, they were not made to me or any other person. If anyone asked you to contribute to a trip or a fund of any kind, it didn't derive from this blog. If you sent something, it was passed on to the appropriate family. My intentions were good, but that does not begin to excuse me for what I've done. My only desire was to share their triumphs and tragedies in a way that showed their strength, the strength of their families. Those were not false. What they went through was real. I felt a great need to tell the stories of three courageous people who wanted nothing but to be well and live happily into their prime. I carry the shame for my actions. The last thing I would like to say is, I'm sorry.
Debbie Swenson was a real woman living in Kansas and the mother of two teenagers, but she'd invented a third child, a basketball star daughter who was sick with cancer in a case of what's known as Munchausen's by internet.
She was based on people that she had known who had had cancer, and what she wanted to do was to write a story that would be inspirational to people who were going through, you know, cancer treatments. She was super sorry about it, and, you know, now she wants to be left alone. Everything before Casey Nicole was encapsulated just because the internet was not as connected as it is now. So it was like little things happening on little islands, and the people on the islands knew about it, but the mainland was unaware. But when Casey Nicole died, suddenly, you know, it was on the mainland. I think it was shortly after that that people from the New York Times started to call. The Hong Kong Sun Post called. The BBC called. There were so many people suddenly involved. And like there was a doctor who was talking about how this is a case of Munchausen's by proxy, but at the same time, not quite, because Casey simply didn't exist.
Munchausen's by proxy is a condition in which a caregiver makes another person appear ill, often their child. That caregiver may actually cause real illness in the process. Some of these faux caregivers enjoy the attention and sympathy they receive by proxy in their role.
It was huge because, as far as I know, this was the first fake suicide on the internet that people outside of the internet had ever heard of. It escaped the internet. That's how big it was.
Before he knew about Debbie Swenson, Halcyon had hosted a funeral service for Casey Nicole on his online radio show.
I talked about her and people called in and we cried together and we mourned her and we told stories about her. A funeral can be a really beautiful experience of community. And all of a sudden, as this became a lie, everything turned dark. And all anybody could talk about was anger and bitterness and betrayal, and you can't trust people.
Halcyon once had bright hopes for the internet as a tool for connection and healing. Now those dreams were slipping through his fingers.
Not only was I mourning, I felt like I had betrayed people, and I felt like instead of adding meaning and love to the world, I had helped create this doubt and distrust and bitterness in the world.
Did you ever find out who was talking when Casey Nicole was supposed to be talking on the phone?
It was Debbie, but it turned out to be Debbie. She changed her voice. And she changed it convincingly enough that people actually bought it. But at the same time, you know, when you go on a phone call, you don't expect somebody to be changing their voice. So you accepted it. Wow, she sounds kind of like Debbie. Well, you know, she's Debbie's daughter. So, you know, big surprise.
Debbie Swenson never admitted to faking Casey's voice on the phone.
How did the community react once it was clear that Casey had been an invention?
There were people who were actual cancer patients who had been talking with her on College Club and an email and things like that, who felt like they had been duped and possibly used for information. And then there were the people who had like sent them money and sent Casey toys and sent them hats. People were heartsick and angry and heartbroken. And the contingent of people who had, you know, financially donated to Casey out of the goodness of their heart felt completely ripped off, and that's when the FBI got involved. The FBI decided that because she had not explicitly solicited gifts, because the gifts were given of people's own free will, and because the amount of money she received did not reach a certain level as to be considered a felony, Debbie was never charged by the FBI. But yeah, we had the FBI up in this.
Others clung to the idea that their own personal truth was nevertheless still meaningful and not to be attacked or undermined.
Sandra was a pariah on Metafilter for quite some time. It was almost as if the fans of Casey Nicole, the people who really felt something about her, didn't want to know whether it was real or not. There was a lot of sentiment of, she was real to me, isn't that enough? I've never really understood why you would want your own personal truth to win out over the actual truth. But I can empathize with it because you don't want to feel like a fool for hurting over somebody who touched your heart.
The story of Casey Nicole and Debbie Swenson is no longer quite so famous. But if you dig in the right places, you'll find its relics. Half-fossilized conversation stubs and blog posts that still express curiosity and shock and anger. Halcyon described feeling so distraught that he punched and broke a plasterboard wall, hurting his hand in the process. He also noted his feelings down in a journal entry called Hoax.
It appears that Casey was not real. I don't know what to say. I'm relieved. I'm crushed. I'm confused. I feel like it's the end of The Sixth Sense or The Usual Suspects, and I'm going through every scene trying to revisualize what really happened. Who sent the Halloween candy? Who emailed me for consolation when her beloved Dr. John died in an auto accident last year? Who sent me the Kansas City Royals hat? KC, get it? And signed it with KC's name. Who did I speak to on the phone and who left me so many voice messages when I was at College Club? Who opened the care package of the cool hats we sent to her to cover her balding head? It seems like I should be spiritually destroyed, but oddly, I don't feel that way. More than anything, I feel surrounded by love. Take Casey out of the equation. You have a community of people who love together, hurt together, learn together, and console each other. My inbox is filled with messages of love. Instead of hugging each other over the death of a 19-year-old girl, we are consoling each other over the death of a belief. Instead of helping each other to keep Casey's spirit alive with each other, we're helping each other keep our faith in humanity alive. To everyone who is extending their hearts to each other now, thank you. Casey may not be real, but the love flowing through the net right now is.
Looking back now, Halsin's perspective is different.
As I reread it now, I recognize that I was forcing myself to believe that and lying a little bit, that inside I was hurt and I was angry that this tool, the internet that I thought to be such a beautiful tool, had been tarnished by this whole experience. And honestly, I never fully recovered from that.
Halcyon had no further contact with Debbie Swenson once Casey Nicole had died.
Have you ever had that curiosity to speak to Debbie? Would you find that healing in any way?
I think at the time, I would have enjoyed that conversation and to hear it. Now I feel like I can't imagine anything that she would say that I would want to be present as she said it. Because honestly, like, I feel like I don't know that person. I knew Casey. So this person would be a total stranger. And I don't know what I would want to say or hear from them.
We reached out to Debbie Swenson in hopes of arranging an interview. We didn't receive a reply to the letters we sent.
But back in May 2001, she did speak to the New York Times about the Casey Nicole hoax. They reported that she seemed embarrassed and contrite.
The whole idea of an online journal is to write what you want to write. I wanted it to be something positive.
After Debbie admitted that she had made up Casey, and after the FBI investigation had closed up, Debbie just kind of disappeared. I mean, she just melted back into the background. Now when somebody screws up, everybody knows it and they know it forever. So that's really different. And there are people now who have lived their entire lives on the internet. So I think that stories like, you know, Casey Nicole sometimes still happen, but I think people are a lot more skeptical of things like that. I think that they treat it more like being in a neighborhood than here I am in this strange and unusual place with all of these people who are like me. It's not the Wild West anymore. It's like New York City now.
Nowadays, stories about alleged Munchausens and about invented internet personae are relatively common. They crop up every so often. From Bell Gibson to the host of people who have been featured on the television program Catfish. In August 2020, an anthropology professor at Arizona State University, who went by the Twitter handle @sciencing_by, was smited down by COVID-19. Later, it turned out she had been a work of fiction all along.
But it seems worth remembering that there was a time when we weren't all so hardened to the possibility of internet fakery.
These types of stories started to come out that people were making up personas online. We started to become more cynical. I think that the people who said, what are we going to all become cynics online? We absolutely have. It took a while. And I think Casey Nicole was one of the tipping points.
I think that there was a loss of innocence. Oh, we can be taken advantage of. There can be wolves amongst us. Casey was one of the first smackdowns and reminders that no matter where you go, the darkness of the world will come with you.
Only Debbie Swenson really knows why she created Casey Nicole and then lived as the teenager for 2 years. But Acrid Rabbit, Patrick, Saundra, and Halcyon all have the sense that she was just lonely. Fiction became her tool for connection.
I don't think that Debbie was trying to pull one over on anybody. I think that Debbie, in writing Casey's story, was trying to connect on some level with the rest of the world.
I think that she was lonely, just like a lot of us are, and wanted to put out a lighthouse and bring people in.
And I think that the absolute yearning for connection that people have explains so much of where the internet has gone nowadays, because I don't think social media would have taken off in the way that it does if people didn't have some sort of that itch at the bottom of their souls. You know, the reason that you post an Instagram picture of your best day, of the best angle for yourself, of the cutest cat you came across this morning, isn't because you want to be superior to everybody. It's because you want everybody to see that way of you being. You want to show yourself as either the best or the worst or the bravest or the strongest or the most badass person. And people still do that. Only Debbie did that in long form in a story that she was able to make up more easily because things were more hidden back then. But I think we do that every day.
Looking back on it now, do you see this as a story that has any kind of take-home message?
I mean, I hate that the message is that keep your guard up a little bit. I think that is one of the messages. People can be whoever they want on the internet, and you need to be careful about how much you give people the benefit of the doubt. Personally, I would rather live in a world where I give people the benefit of the doubt, and every once in a while I get embarrassed and burned.
I think that people take care of each other online when they can. That doesn't mean that bad people can't get online and do bad things. They certainly do. But I really think that people do value the communities they create online, and they figure out ways to make sure that everybody's there and having a good time and being their most honest version of their self.
To me, there's before Casey where this wasn't possible, and after Casey where this was possible. And then how you change your behavior based on the possibility that you can get burned, that's really up to you.
Halcyon chooses to keep projecting positivity.
Hello. Welcome to the Hug Nation YouTube channel. My name's Halcyon. I have been doing this for a very long time. There's a whole bunch of archives on all sorts of topics.
We contacted the FBI to verify whether they looked into this case. They told us they had no comment.
Suicide is created and produced by Poppy Damon and Alice Fiennes. The lead producer of this series is me, Alice Fiennes, and I also wrote this episode. Our audio production and music are by Mike Migas, and additional production support was provided by Elizabeth Nakano.
In this episode, you heard from Halcyon, Saundra Mitchell, Patrick Cleary, and Acrid Rabbit. Casey Nicole's blog, Living Colors, is no longer online. So in this episode, we pieced her voice together from archived blog entries and from emails that were reposted on forums. We also used the Wayback Machine where possible. These extracts were performed by Brenna Daldoff and her real mum, Sandra Issa.